The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I could spend 3 days preparing to take a doctor's deposition in a malpractice case easily. And preparation means making sure I know my facts, reading medical literature that's relevant. If the witness has been deposed before, reading old transcripts. Those are the ways that, you know, that we do it. And then it's how do you convert all of this into a story? And a story that if you can't tell it in about 2 minutes, then there's something wrong with the case or with you.
Neil Roth shares his trial preparation techniques and how often a good settlement is better than a great verdict.
Lawyers who decide this is what a case is worth, and if this isn't offered, we are going to try this case no matter what, that's when ego gets in your way, okay? You have to have a self-awareness of the fact that cases belong to clients, not to lawyers.
And the sometimes funny insight on how he manages the law firm he started with Stuart Grossman.
We started October 1 of 1988. Would you like to guess how many times Stuart Grossman has asked to look at the financial records of this firm?
Zero.
And you're right.
Lucky
zero. Not once. Because we have a relationship and it's one of trust, and that's how you lead and that's how you manage. If people don't trust you, leave. You don't belong where you are.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference in the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. He really wanted to be a doctor, but a bad automobile accident in his teens that almost killed him, twice, landed Neil Roth in a courtroom as a plaintiff in a personal injury lawsuit. It was that early legal experience that convinced him to marry his desire for medicine with law and pursue a career as a medical malpractice trial lawyer. He has lent his penetrating, decisive focus to the Florida Justice Association as its president. He's also been honored with its Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award and the Perry Nichols Award, the FJA's most prestigious. Neil Roth sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in May of 2019 for an in-depth discussion of his trial preparation techniques, how he runs a law practice, and his special relationship with his founding law partner, Stuart Grossman.
Neil, you are, of course, the Roth of the Grossman Roth Yaffa Cohen Law Firm here in Coral Gables. You started as a defense lawyer, and you had a rather out-of-the-box idea to start a law firm with Stuart Grossman. Please tell us about that.
Well, after becoming a plaintiff's lawyer and having my own office, I got to the point where I was just so busy that I knew that I needed to be in a partnership with another lawyer and ultimately other lawyers. And so I had known Stuart since the beginning of my career. We chatted a bit about it. I wrote him a letter outlining my vision of what a law firm would look like. And over the course of almost a year, we had ongoing discussions about it, culminating with a decision to start what was then Grossman and Roth in October of 1988.
There's a story that goes with that too, right?
there is. while many people may think Stuart is a very decisive individual, as it came to this issue, he was anything but. And one of my strengths is being decisive in terms of knowing what I want and what I'm trying to accomplish and always asking what's the goal? What's the goal? What does the client want? What are we trying to accomplish here? And so by the middle of September, a decision hadn't been made. I found out that he was out of town and returning to Miami, and I told his longtime Secretary Donna Burroughs, what time does he arrive? And tell him I'm going to pick him up. And I picked him up at the Miami airport, and I asked him to look at the gas gauge in the car, and I was virtually on empty. And he said, why are you without gas? And I said, well, we're going to stay in this car until a decision is made, and either we will do it before we run out of gas or after we run out of gas. We left Miami International Airport. We must have passed a dozen gas stations along the way. And he kept saying, don't you need to stop? And I said, no, Stuart, we need to make a decision. And we ran out of gas on Sunset Drive, and the decision was made, and we formed the firm.
Kind of like a husband-wife kind of thing going on there in some respect.
Well, I think it's more knowing that with respect to any relationship, there's a time. Either you're going to make it or you're not. And delaying and putting it off until tomorrow is something I don't believe in and is one of my pet peeves. If you want to get something done, do it now. Don't wait till tomorrow. You may not have the opportunity tomorrow to do it. So that's the story, October 1, 1988. It's been 30 great years.
And I suppose you have no regrets then if you operate in that mindset, because if the circumstance had changed and you missed the opportunity to make the decision, you'd be kicking yourself.
I think we both would be if we, for any reason, either one of us let that opportunity pass, because to use the colloquial phrase, I said, if we build it, they will come. And we built it, and they did. And we're very grateful for all the clients who we've been able to represent.
Oh, boy, and how they have come. I mean, multi-million dollar settlements, decisions that have set case law, had impact on other jurisprudence and litigation in the state. You are perhaps best known for medical and other malpractice type of cases, but you have certainly spread your wings throughout your personal career as a lawyer, and that's been important to you, hasn't it?
It has. I think that to be a complete lawyer and to be a complete trial lawyer, you can't be afraid to venture out into areas that are a little bit foreign to you. I think we all can get good at doing something, and I think my body of work in medical malpractice speaks for itself. But if an interesting legal malpractice case comes along, or an employment case comes along, or something where you just feel somebody, you know, has been harmed and you need to figure out how do you solve the problem and is there a solution, you know, behind it, you know, you can't be afraid to take a chance. Be confident in yourself and your abilities. A trial lawyer's talents and skills spread through a wide variety of areas of law. And so don't be afraid, and I haven't.
One of your most famous cases, and I'm sure it holds a particular significance for you, is a little girl named Chantel Berman.
So Chantel Berman was born and at 3 months of age had what's called failure to thrive, so she wasn't growing properly. And a very long story short is that a workup was done at a local hospital. An EKG was done, which was part of the workup. It was read by an adult cardiologist, and it was misread. And it took almost 6 years till the disease process itself manifested itself in something called pulmonary hypertension, which back then was not really treatable. And we took on the case even though the statute of limitations may very well had run on it, and we had to figure out a way to navigate through that morass, if you will. The medicine became very, very complicated, but we were able to put that together, got great experts from around the country. And what was particularly important to me is that Chantel was born on November 26th of 1979, which was just 2 months after my older daughter was born. And so representing a child virtually the same age as my older daughter took on a special meaning to me, because I was thinking, what if this would have happened to Melissa? And when we were able to finally get the case resolved, we not only got appropriate compensation for Chantel, but we had the hospital institute a policy that every EKG on any children 12 and under were to be read by a pediatric cardiologist, because it is very clear that had a pediatric cardiologist seen that EKG, they would have been able to make the diagnosis of what was wrong with her heart.
Oh my goodness. So you actually affected positive policy change.
Yes, and while I cannot say for certain how many children's lives have been spared misery or even death, I know that there are many because we were able to get that done.
Neil, you were born in Brooklyn, New York, but you came down here to South Florida as a young boy, age four. Tell me, what made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
Well, the truthful answer is that I actually wanted to be a doctor. But my skill set fell into the area of political science, English, history, not really biology and math and chemistry. And so I realized that my talents and skills and intellect was better suited towards the law. I had been involved in a very bad accident at 15 years of age, and that exposed me to the legal system because a claim was brought against a driver who injured me very significantly, from which I almost died twice. And so at the age of 16 and 17, I watched firsthand one of the great titans of that era in the 60s, Murray Sams, handle my case. And then it became sort of a natural to marry law and medicine, because I still liked medicine and knew that I could learn what I needed to learn. And so that's how it all came together.
And you've really had to become an expert in medicine, haven't you?
You have to learn the medicine in each case to the best of your ability. You can't question a doctor without at least understanding what the principles are. And you have to do your research, you have to read articles, you have to read textbooks, you have to learn the medicine from your experts. You're never going to know as much as the doctor sitting across the table from you, but you have to let that doctor know that, or at least think, you know as much as you need to. And that's what's so important about doing that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. What were your influences growing up?
Well, my influences were really my family. My dad didn't have even a high school degree. My mother did. It was a family where both mom and dad worked, and I respected the work ethic. We're Jewish, and although we weren't super observant, the holidays were always an important time for family to be together. And those are the things that you watch as you're a young child growing up. My father may not have had the most book sense or intelligence as any other people, but he had more common sense in his finger than most people had in their entire brain. And so when you grow up in that environment, you can learn to learn things intellectually, but there's no replacement for someone who has a great deal of experience with life and who develops common sense. And when you can blend those two, it really makes you a better person.
Yeah, and wisdom.
Wisdom can't be replaced.
Yeah. Did you have a mentor when you started in law?
Well, because I was on the defense side for a short period of time, I like the people that I worked with, but I don't consider any of those people to be mentors. Back in the late 70s when I started, there was really three or four major plaintiffs' lawyers in Dade County. J.B. Spence, where Stewart was one. Aaron Pothurst was another. And there were a few others, but Stanley Rosenblatt was really, you know, among the top back then. And I had defended a case that he was handling, and he and one of his partners thought that I might have the talent to go to that side. And it is something that I realized quite early I would be better suited to do because of my natural affinity towards the underdog, the hurt individual. And so Stanley would be my mentor. And I learned a great deal in the 6.5 years that I worked with him. We tried a lot of cases together. He taught me a lot about discovery and how to take depositions. When I first showed up to work, he had been featured in People magazine. There was a box of letters, literally, from people all over the country about their claims or complaints or what happened to them. And he just said, "Neil, go figure out these cases. Are they good ones or not?"
Wow.
And I was only out of law school about a year and a half when he gave me that responsibility. But you got to learn somewhere, and you got to learn from the bottom. So you start with, what's the story? And where does it take you?
Well,
and how can you direct it?
It's a tremendous responsibility for someone just out of law school.
Yep.
Obviously, you put your sorting hat on and did a good job because you worked for him for quite a while.
We did. We had a very good relationship. for 6.5 years, and then the firm started to take on a look that I wasn't going to be comfortable with long term, and decided that I would be best suited to go out on my own for a while to see what the field might look like after a few years. And so I opened my own office.
Okay.
Took 8 cases with me. And when Stuart and I formed the firm a little more than 3 years later, I had 80 cases.
Wow.
Yes. Which is why I needed help.
Stuart to the rescue. How did you, as a young lawyer, how did you go about honing your trial skills?
Well, there's a number of ways to do it. You have to see the connection between the facts of your case, the law that applies in medical malpractice, the medicine, and how are you going to take depositions. Depositions, to me, are the most important thing that we do because they set the framework for the case, the theme of the case. You get the witnesses locked in. You know, I can honestly say that in 42 years in deposing defendants in cases, I've never walked away from a deposition without getting something that helped my case. And that's what you have to look for. What can you get out of this witness that will take you one step closer to the goal?
You described yourself as tenacious. Others have certainly called you a strategist, someone who really is probing. Is there one particular key or one particular skill you think to your success over these years?
Yeah, I think whether you want to call it a skill or a methodology, it's an unwavering commitment to preparation. There is no substitute in what we do, and there are no shortcuts. You've got to prepare. To this day, again, 42 years later, I don't prepare for a deposition without a notepad in front of me and a pen in my hand and making an outline all the time. And the outlines grow as the case moves on, as more and more information is learned, and I want to question witnesses about it. So I could spend 3 days preparing to take a doctor's deposition in a malpractice case easily. And preparation means making sure I know my facts, reading medical literature that's relevant. If the witness has been deposed before, reading old transcripts. Those are the ways that, you know, that we do it. And then it's how do you convert all of this into a story? And a story that if you can't tell it in about 2 minutes, then there's something wrong with the case or with you. Because if you can't summarize that case in a way that it's easily understood to the jurors who are going to hear it, then you've got a real problem.
Interesting. Did you used to get nervous before trial?
I still get nervous before trial.
They say the good ones do.
The hardest part of trying cases is not from the moment you walk into the courtroom and get ready to pick a jury. The hardest part of trying cases is the preparation for the actual trial. Because then you've collected all of this information. Sometimes thousands and tens of thousands of pages of deposition testimony, exhibits, medical information, and so forth. And then you have to put that all together to be able to go in and tell the trial story to the jury in a way that they can understand. And so often trial lawyers think we know, and then we find out maybe we don't know what the jury understood, what they were thinking about, what they were looking for in a case. A lot of it, I think you mentioned earlier, instincts. There's a lot of instincts that go into this, and you've got to trust them.
And despite all of that preparation, despite just plain old hard work, sometimes things don't go your way within a case or the actual decision on the case. How do you handle that disappointment?
I've had this psychological ability to be able to put behind me things that didn't go well. Other than to learn from the experience and not repeat it, you can't dwell on it, because if you dwell on it, it will eat you up. And you can't deal in what ifs or what may have been for something that has happened. It's done. It's behind you. You have to say, what did I learn? And then move forward. And how am I not going to let that happen again? So it's a psychological mechanism. Some people might want to call it denial. I don't really think it's denial. I think it's recognition. And that going back doesn't help you other than to learn.
Seems a very practical way of looking at it, is if it doesn't serve a purpose, then why does it exist in your head? Tell us about the role that ego plays in being a good lawyer.
I think we all, to some degree, have egos. Some are bigger than others. I think you have to just channel this concept of ego in a positive way and not in a negative way. You can't let it get in your way, if that makes sense. Because if you let your ego get in your way, then you're not going to be thinking about questions like I said earlier. What's the goal? What does the client need? What does the client want? Sometimes what the client needs and what the client wants are two different things, and you can only deliver one and not the other. And you have to be able to recognize that. And so, you know, lawyers who decide this is what a case is worth, and if this isn't offered, we are going to try this case no matter what, that's when ego gets in your way, okay? You have to have a self-awareness of the fact that cases belong to clients, not to lawyers. And sometimes the hardest thing you have to do is say, you know, I can't do any better than this. And my best recommendation to the client is resolve your case. You know, it's often said a good settlement is better than a great verdict.
Mm. Now, you're not only a lawyer, but you also run a law firm. What are the secrets to your day-to-day success? It's a very tough profession to begin with, but then you also have to manage a law firm, and lawyers traditionally are not the best managers.
Well, there are a couple of things that have to be done. Number one is you have to lead by example. So if you expect the people in your law firm to work hard, then you have to work hard. You also have to understand that you're dealing with an eclectic group of people, from the lawyers to the medical investigators to the legal investigators to the paralegals to everyone else who makes a law firm run. You need to have an open door policy. Sometimes, even though you have that, it's not utilized. And I'm oft quoted as saying, how does anybody here expect me to know something's going on if you don't tell me? So please, the door is open. I make myself available. I come to the office all the time. You know, I'm here. A lot of lawyers work differently, but they all know my schedule. They all know where I'll be. If I'm not in court or in deposition or in trial, they know that I will be home working by 8 a.m. I'll be in this office by 10, and I stay here till at least 6 o'clock unless I have something to do. And that way I cover the full gamut of everybody who's going to be here, and we talk. You know, you have to be honest, you have to be open. You have to tell people you've done a good job, or you could do better, and this is how you do it. I'm a great believer in constructive criticism, not just criticism. And so you take all of that, and then you have to have the skill set. Some people are managers, some aren't. Some people know how to talk to people in a certain way, some don't. I think I've been blessed with that skill set where I can have a conversation with a lawyer or anybody else in the office and have it in a way that they'll walk away feeling good about what we've discussed, even if it doesn't come out the way they thought it should. You have to have an open mind. You have to be flexible. You have to be understanding. Not everybody has that skill set. I've been blessed with it. I don't know quite why, but I am. And so, and I'm willing to take on the tasks that other people don't want to do. And I will tell you one very funny story about being managing partner of this law firm. We started October 1 of 1988. Would you like to guess how many times Stuart Grossman has asked to look at the financial records of this firm?
Zero.
And you're right.
Lucky
zero.
Guess.
Not once. Because we have a relationship and it's one of trust. And that's how you lead, and that's how you manage. If people don't trust you, leave. You don't belong where you are. And trust is not just instinctive, trust is earned. And so that's the skill set that I'm blessed in having, and I have good people who help me. you know, good accountants, good lawyers, you know, who help you get through it. And, you know, not being afraid to ask for help, right? You can't do it all yourself. We've got close to 50 employees here, you know, in three different offices. Wow. It takes a lot of work to manage that group of people.
Absolutely.
And you just have to, you have to do it. You have to be here. And a large part of management here is just strategic thinking. So I get phone calls every day from lawyers all in all three offices. Here's what's going on in my case. What do you think? And I listen. I offer my best advice and hope that they'll execute a plan that we've agreed upon.
Neil, you've had a long involvement with the Florida Justice Association. You're a past president. You've won the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award, which recognizes a career of courage, leadership, devotion, setting the example, as you just said, is a good function of a manager. You've won the Perry Nichols Award, the FJA's most prestigious, for the select few who set the standard for the rest to aspire to. You're a Silver Eagle, Crystal Eagle recipient over the years for your contributions. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, for one, I think it's made me a much better lawyer than I otherwise would have been in any number of ways. There are two main aspects of FJA's work in this state. There's the legislative side and there's the political side, which are obviously interrelated. And developing relationships with legislators over the years has been very rewarding and helpful. I consider one of my dearest friends, former state senator Alex Villalobos, mm-hmm. who we come to the world differently, but we love each other nonetheless, and we can talk and we can think through issues and we can help solve problems. You know, unfortunately, in today's political environment and climate, the word bipartisan doesn't exist. But if we were to survive as trial lawyers in this state starting in the mid-90s, you had to be bipartisan. And I and a couple of others like Howard Coker, we coined the phrase a functional majority. That's what we need. We need a group of Republicans and Democrats who at least have an open mind, care about the citizens, can care about the consumers, individual rights, access to the courts, a fair civil justice system. And while we've taken a lot of hits along the way, nonetheless, 42 years later, I'm still here with Stuart and Andy and Gary and the rest of the people representing individuals who's have suffered catastrophic losses. And we've been able to make recoveries for them, maybe not what they might have been before legislation, but certainly in most instances to meet their needs. And so, those are just some of the ways when you're involved in the legislative process and you're reading bills and you're working out language, it really teaches you to think about the fact that words do matter, not just those that are spoken as we talk about now, but how they're written and how a comma, an or, an additional phrase can completely change your particular statute for the betterment of your clients. And then convincing the people who are going to pass these bills this is the right thing to do and why, you know. And so that relationships, I'm blessed to get referrals from other FJA members around the state who've recognized the body of work of our firm, and we've been able to help some of their clients as well. So it's been a very meaningful part of my life.
And your colleagues, I should say, have made a special note of your skills as a strategist in dealing with the legislature. It seems to be something you're not only particularly good at, but that you enjoy. And you've had success.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed a great deal working in that arena, if you will.
Neil, how important is it to give back to the FJA, especially its foundation that focuses on education, on research, continuing education for attorneys?
Well, I wish that we could do a little bit better, and I know that we've been trying to do things a little bit better. We do have some additional money now that came in through a class action that my firm handled, but you know, you do have to give back. You have to make sure that the organization will sustain itself. Here I'm at a point in my career where honestly I'm not nearly as worried about myself or my wife or my two daughters and sons-in-law and six grandchildren, But I do worry about the younger lawyers, and that this system that we have and has been in place since the beginning of this country, when the right to trial by jury was guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, that it be maintained and it be consistent and that it be fair. And so you've got to be able to have the financial resources to keep an organization going. And, you know, we have certainly done our share over the years.
You've been heavily involved as well, and you've influenced the processes of law as well. You were appointed by the Florida Supreme Court to serve on two independent commissions in the past, one to study jury trials and civic participation in the system, but the other was to study litigation, which led to a new rule of civil procedure. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a very rewarding experience because we felt, those of us who were appointed and ultimately met over a period of a couple of years, felt that the litigants needed some more guidance and assistance from the courts, particularly in complex cases, that the goal of such cases should not be to see how long they take to be concluded, but how short a period of time it can be done, but still in fairness to both sides. And so, yes, we studied the issue, we heard from a lot of different people, we exchanged a lot of different views. And one thing good about having served on a Supreme Court commission like that one, studying complex litigation, I also was a member of the Civil Jury Instruction Committee for 6 years, is that different lawyers from different walks of life with different point of views can all get together. And when an individual case is not on the table, but the betterment of the system as a whole, it's amazing how much camaraderie there is. And there's amazing how much give and take there can be, you know, to accomplish a greater goal of making the system better. And so we think that that rule, you know, makes the system better.
Do you have any other concerns about the future of the legal profession?
I think my concerns are the, and I think they're more right now because of this time that we're in. I think that the
meaning the contentiousness that
the contentiousness
exists
in our political environment. And you know, the founding fathers really got it right when they said we need to have three separate but co-equal branches of government, each with the ability to have checks and balances on the other. And my concern is that right now the judiciary is not nearly as independent as it should be, that the very appointment of judges or election of judges, depending upon what you're dealing with, has become overly politicized. Almost like if you're appointed by a certain president or governor or whatever, like you must follow that political ideology or, you know, you'll be horribly criticized. You know, some of the greatest jurists came from some walk of life where people believed they would either be a lean a little left or lean a little right. And the greatest ones are the ones who they thought would lean a little right, but actually turned out to be down the middle or a little left, or the ones that were a little bit too far to the left wound up being closer to the middle, so that we don't have these political ideologies, you know, driving the decisions, but rather, as an independent judiciary, what is the law? What statute got passed by a state legislature or Congress? What's the common law that's not been addressed by Congress or state legislatures? And how will a common law work in conjunction with that? And that should not be driven by whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. It should be driven by what's the law? What are we trying to accomplish? How are we going to protect our citizens? Not one group or the other, but all of them. And that's my greatest concern right now, is that the appointments are way too politicized, and the people who are applying have requirements like, if you're not a member of the Federalist Society, don't even bother to apply. Mm-hmm. That saddens me, because that's not what it should be. You should be able to look at an individual lawyer who wants to be a judge and look at he or she on the merits of who they are, the body of their work, and don't label them. Will they be fair? Will they be impartial? Will they follow the law? Will they do the right thing? Okay. Well, are they people who have an open mind? Are they willing to hear and listen to other people's views? Or are they so dogmatic that they don't? Those are the things that really worry me.
This is a tough profession. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Well, it was harder to do when I was younger because the demands on me in whatever law firm I was in, and ultimately, you know, in this one, was to make it as successful as possible. You know, the byproduct of that is that, you know, you're doing good things for your family. But this is not a 9-to-5 job. This is 24 hours a day or whatever it takes to do it. And so, you know, you do what you can. You try to carve out the time you can for your wife, for your children as they were growing up. But sometimes you're gone for too many days. And sometimes that has a negative impact. But you do what you can to make it up to them. You go to school activities. You try to be there when you can. But sometimes you have to have a relationship like I have with my wife where she just understands and gets it, that what you're trying to do is not just for my family or my law firm, you know, but for all of the people in the state. There was a period of time when I was moving up the chairs at FJA, and over a 4-year period, where I counted up the number of days I spent in Tallahassee, and it was 360 days.
Wow.
In a 4-year period.
Wow.
And so, you know, that took a toll on my life with my wife and my children, but ultimately, I think they all understood I wasn't ignoring them or didn't think they were important. It was trying to do something better, trying to also set examples. That's also true of my involvement early on with my synagogue when I was president of Bet Shurah back in 1992. Took a lot of time to do it, and maybe too much, and maybe I was gone for far too many meetings. But you have to weigh what are you trying to do and setting examples. I think back then my children would have not been terribly happy with me, but never really expressed it. I think looking back now, I think they're glad their father did those things.
Do you have any regrets?
Probably the only regret is maybe doing too much of that and not finding a way to balance it a little bit better. In my practice, there was a period of time of, say, 25 years, the first 25, where I couldn't delegate. I wanted to handle everything myself because maybe I was a control freak or I didn't think other people could do it. And then it was almost as if one day it all clicked and I said, we have a great law firm with great young lawyers. If I'm not willing to delegate, then why are they here? Okay, if I'm not willing to give them a chance to prove that they can do things, why are they here? And so I started delegating a lot more and letting a lot of the other younger lawyers do things on my cases. And it's turned out to be the best years of my practice. My relationship with my partner, Natasha Cortez, is remarkable. We've been together for 21 years. And having her go through all of that and being able to give her those responsibilities and understanding how we each think about things makes us a very formidable team when we handle a case.
And isn't that how law firms survive the retirements of their founders?
Yes. I mean, if you want your law firm to go on, you better have people behind you who can do the work. I mean, we talk often, Stuart and I and Andy and Gary, about this being a legacy law firm and that Grossman Roth Yaffa Cohen will be here long after either Stuart or I retire or pass on.
Neil, how would you like to be remembered?
On a professional basis, I would like to be remembered as someone who cared a great deal about his clients and who went always the extra mile to do whatever I could to make their life better, to be a difference maker for them. And since they have such tremendous needs, that I've been able to at least help them, get them through a terrible ordeal, whether they survived it or they lost a loved one. I think that's probably the most important and rewarding thing is that someone could say, you know, Neil Roth, he really cared about his clients and he really worked as hard as he could. On a personal basis, I would like to be remembered as a husband who cared deeply and loved his wife very much, and whose family, whenever possible, did come first, and that I've been able to pass on to my children and also my grandchildren, who ages range from 3 to 12, some of life's lessons, the word you used before, wisdom, you know, setting an example, so that when the time comes, when Papa is not here any longer to be able to help, they'll have the tools.
Neil Roth, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
You're welcome, and I thank you for the time.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.